knife.
A podcast of the cinema.
I said linoleum knife just as I was trying to get close enough to my microphone to say linoleum knife, and I think I got it.
Yeah. I'm going to say that people will fill in the blanks if they if you didn't.
The cord got a little tangly as I was trying to make the spin.
Well, they know where they are.
It's an analog situation.
Very. Always. You're Dave White. I'm Alonzo Duraldi. We're film critics, and we're spouses.
And
And this is our show.
And we're hungry.
Pretty much. I'm hungry on a regular basis.
I'm really hungry. It's Monday afternoon. It's about 4 o'clock, and I'm...
Come around all peckish?
I'm going to make... The minute we're done here, I'm hopping on the stove, and I'm going to make mac and cheese.
Ooh!
Like the kind I made that one time. No Kraft.
Okay. Not the Malcolm and Marie mac and cheese.
Good heavens, no. Although that is its own thing. Like,
sure, sometimes you want a hamburger and sometimes you want a Big Mac.
Yeah.
These are different things.
Now, remember that time for lunch? I was like, mac and cheese. We have no mac and cheese. How do I get some mac and cheese real fast?
Mm-hmm.
Is there such a thing as from scratch mac and cheese that you can make really quickly? Turns out there is.
I do remember that. It was very delicious, and I look forward to eating that again.
We have all of those ingredients
right
now, thanks to the pandemic pantry.
Mm-hmm.
We got it all.
The pantry.
I would stop this podcast right now to make it, then eat it, and then return to the podcast. But
don't tease.
I'm going to just go.
We're going to power through.
I'm going to professionally power through because
now you've planted that in my head.
You're excited.
I'll be 75% at best thinking about movies for the next hour.
The good news is that it is ready in under 20 minutes.
Well, okay then.
When you make
then
it.
Let's go.
The reason I'm doing it is because there's a giant bunch of chard in the crisper.
Uh-huh.
And it's got to get at before its time on Earth is finished.
Yes.
And I thought, okay, well, that chard is part of dinner tonight, so how's this going to work? And I thought, well, I can just saute that chard and make it, you know. Frankly, just dump a bunch of adobo spice on the chard, and it's fine.
As long as it's not touching my beautiful mac and cheese.
No. This is going to be in the separate compartment of your tray.
My cafeteria tray.
Your cafeteria tray.
I don't like it with the food touching. I actually don't care about the food touching. I have many food crazy things, but that's not one of them.
As much as I am in forever love with chard, I know it's a thing you eat because it's good for you and not because it's your first choice.
Yeah. Although, you know, enough bacon grease and...
There's no bacon grease.
Okay,
yeah.
Fine.
But there is...
Enough adobo spice.
Plenty of beautiful chard. And I thought, how can I make eating chard for dinner something that Alonzo Duralde will want?
Mm.
And I thought, oh, that mac and cheese.
You know me so well.
I know how to do things.
You know how to carrot and stick me.
If you eat all your chard, you get the mac and cheese.
Okay.
Who's a good boy?
Here comes the airplane.
I it's been a very stressful day, and
I'm sorry.
And I need a breezy, light episode, no one yelling at me. That's what I need. Are you gonna commit to that?
I'm here for breezy.
Are you gonna commit to not yelling at me and making everything breezy and light today?
I promise.
Perfect. Let's move into discussing cinema. We have 6 movies. However, 2 of them we're tabling.
Yes.
The 2 that we are tabling are Together Together and Limbo.
Yes.
And we are tabling them. We are Sorry, let me start that over again.
Please
we are tabling them because both of them are currently in theaters only.
Correct.
You've seen them both.
Yes.
You've written about them both.
Yes.
For the rap.
Yes.
.com.
Yes. So people are...
on the internet.
Yes. They can go read those reviews.
You can
reviews.
Go read the reviews. However, the screening links that were provided to us from publicists mm-hmm. are now...
yes.
Into the air. Back into the atmosphere.
Right.
I can't see them. I'm not in a movie theater yet. My 2 weeks post second shot is not here yet.
Correct.
So we're going to wait until both of these films arrive on streaming platforms.
Yes.
Which will be very soon.
Mm-hmm.
Like a couple weeks.
Yeah.
And then we'll talk about them.
Yes.
Because you love them both.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's important. Like if you see a movie that is kind of and then I ask you, oh, is it worth, you know, watching to talk about it? You said, I'll just talk about it on the show and you don't have to worry about it.
Yeah.
That's fine. But when you say, oh, I really want you to see these.
Speaking of which,
yeah.
This won't be a review, but I just want to mention real quick a movie that people should keep an eye out on because it will drop before our next episode.
Mm-hmm.
Dropping this Thursday, May 6th, on Netflix, is a new documentary called In Our Mother's Gardens.
Which I have seen about 40 minutes of, thanks to you, and yes. I was sitting here at the table while you were watching it.
It's really quite good. And
it's called what?
In Our Mother's Gardens.
In Our Mother's Gardens.
Yes.
You know, and do you know what I'm going to always be calling it? Because I can't remember the shortened...
In Search of Our Mother's
the
Gardens.
The shortened, yes. Adapted name. I'm going to be thinking of it and always calling it, I apologize in advance to the filmmaker, Chantrell Lewis, that I will always want to call it In Search of Our Mother's
Gardens.
She
intentionally was referencing Alice Walker's, you know...
Alice Walker wrote a book of essays in the 80s after The Color Purple.
Yes.
And it was called In Search of Our Mother's Gardens.
Yes. The title essay she wrote in the early 70s, and it was a direct inspiration for this documentary. The film actually opens with an Alice Walker quote.
Right. And so, but I read the Alice Walker book of essays in the 80s when I was in college.
Me too.
And so I've always, that's in my head.
Yes.
For 35 years. And so, because I'm, you and I are,
no,
you know, 100. And then now there's this film with a different name, but almost the same. And I'm never going to remember it.
Yeah, this happens all the time where like somebody will take a well-known title or a classic title and change it a bit. And then you have to remember which one you're talking about.
Right.
Anyway, the documentary In Our Mother's Gardens, premiering on Netflix. I highly recommend that people check it out. I also highly recommend that people check out a film and a movie this week, because Daniel and I talked to Chantrell Lewis about that film and about Julie Dash's legendary Daughters of the Dust.
Yep.
And it's a great conversation. Chantrell Lewis is a fascinating person who has traveled the world and studied and written, and now she's making movies. And I can't wait to see what other movies she makes, because she has she's a terrific storyteller. She has a lot to say and really interesting insights.
I'll be watching this.
Yeah.
We will now review a film that has been around for a very long time. You first saw it where? At which film festival?
I'm not even sure where we're starting here.
The Human Voice.
Oh, yes. Goodness. I believe it premiered at Venice. I saw it which didn't have a virtual component. And since I didn't go to Venice, I didn't see it there. But
I thought you did.
No, I didn't see anything. But I
saw it premiered at 2020 Venice.
Correct.
All right.
I saw it for 2020.
Getting myself all mixed up here.
Well, I saw it for 2020 New York, which was like a month or two later.
Okay. And that was the screening that we had here.
Correct.
In our pandemic home.
Yes.
In the middle of everything horrible.
Yes.
And we watched it September.
Yes.
Of 2020.
And then this spring, it actually, I guess, I don't know if it was because of Oscar qualification or whatever, but it did start popping up in some places. It screened at a drive-in here, which, I would have killed to have gone to. And I believe it's opening, it either opened this past Friday or this coming Friday at the Landmark here in Los Angeles, connected to Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown.
Yeah, so it has been in theaters now for a couple weeks.
A couple months.
As... a double feature with women on the verge of a nervous breakdown.
Yes.
And the reason it has been in a double feature with women on the verge of a nervous breakdown is because it is a film by Pedro Almodovar.
Yes.
It is his first English language film. Mm-hmm. It is also in a double feature with women on the verge of a nervous breakdown because it is a short film. It's 30 minutes long.
Mm-hmm.
It is also in a double bill with women on the verge of a nervous breakdown because it's the same story.
Yes.
All right. Now explain everything.
So when Almodovar was making Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown, the first of a series of muses that he worked with, the actress Carmen Maura, was performing Cocteau's Human Voice in Madrid. It is a one-woman theater piece. La voix humaine. La voix humaine.
Sorry, France. I'm terrible at that.
And in fact, if you see Almodovar's film Law of Desire, you see a snippet of her performing the piece. So he wanted to make that into a movie.
Yeah.
But he wanted it to be a feature-length film. So he was trying to sort of expand upon it and add to it. And as he did that, it became more and more farcical. And the results were Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown. But the core of the piece is about a woman waiting for her lover who is leaving her to call her to sort of officially end things. And it involves packing up his bags. Like, there's a lot of elements. People, if you're watching Human Voice and you've seen Women on the Verge, you'd be like, is that where he got the... And this happens too.
Right.
So there's a lot of connective tissue between the two. But yeah, Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown began life as a screen adaptation of The Human Voice and then just went way off in its own wonderfully distinct direction. But obviously, it's material that means a lot to Señor Almodovar, and now he is approaching it very, you know, it's still considered an adaptation, but it's a much closer adaptation than anything he's done before. And it is, like you said, his first film in English, starring the great Tilda Swinton. And how those two haven't worked together before now, I mean, come on.
This is peanut butter and chocolate. This is a Reese's cup.
Yeah.
They were meant to be together.
For sure.
Someone's banging on the door.
Yes.
Why are they banging on the door?
I think a package is being delivered.
I'm not answering the door.
Tilda needs to work with all the gay filmmakers.
But specifically this one.
Yes.
The way that, you know, Derek Jarman used to, you know, showcase her.
Yes.
Reminds me a lot, you know, the way Almodovar employs her reminds me a lot of the way Derek Jarman used to.
Absolutely.
Is she is not only the star, she's part of the design.
She's also a set.
She's a human. She's an object. She's a chair. She's, you know, an outfit. She's part of the overall look of everything, in addition to being the physical human,
the protagonist.
I guess we have to stop the recording and find out what's going on.
Let's
banging on the door.
Okay. Today was the day that we had 8,000 packages.
That was an upheaval.
Yeah.
So many
beeping
things,
clunkings,
sitting outside the door, and the man was banging on the door, and now there are all these boxes. I'm not even going to open them up until Christmas. Let me tell you something. This vaccine is making people, I think, crave the human contact.
Uh-huh.
Even the delivery people.
Yes.
Are just like, no, come. come. I'm just going to bang on your door.
you don't have to sign anything. I just want
to talk to you. I'm just going to bang on your door until you come to the door. And we're going to have a little chat about the packages I'm delivering. There are six of them.
Well, speaking of which, The Human Voice, this was a film that was announced some time ago.
Yeah.
In fact, the one of the last times I was out in the world was when I was I got to do a Q&A with Almodovar.
Yes.
During award season, yes. Right before he won the LAFCA Award for Best Foreign Film for Pain and Glory. And we talked about it. And then the pandemic happened, and this wound up being the perfect movie to make during a pandemic because it's a one-person film. Like,
sort of, more or less.
There is one scene in which she goes to a like the world's most beautiful hardware store.
Okay, stop just for a second.
You want a hatchet in that?
I want to live in the hardware store in Almodovar's mind.
Mm.
First of all, again, yes, you're right. There are gleaming hatchets all in a row. But you know, the apartments in his movies are the kind of places where you just aren't. It's like people living in a Pinterest, you know, page, and this hardware store is no different. Like, it's the most Almodovarishly decorated hardware store, perfectly organized, just meticulously arranged and gleamingly clean and
space.
She's in there with this coat and this bag, and you're.
She buys a hatchet and they wrap it up for her like it's flowers in brown paper. That's Agustin Almodovar, his brother and producer, by the way.
Right.
As the clerk. And you can even tell, like, there are other people in the hardware store and they've been sort of green screened in somehow.
Or else they're like super far away from her.
Yeah. So basically it's like it's her and the producer, and then the rest of the movie is just her and the one of the most talented dogs I've ever seen in a movie. So it's like the exact kind of, like, if you're going to try and figure out how to make a movie during, like, the, we're not talking about, like, oh, it's Canada and, you know, time enough had passed and as long as you were tested and blah, blah, blah. No, Spain, who got it really terrible.
And we know this for a fact because we talk to
my sister every week.
Every week on Zoom from Spain.
And they were shooting this in, like, you know, March, April, like early peak terrible time, but because of the minimalness, and he's certainly never a minimal filmmaker, but I guess crew wise they were
minimal, you know? People, minimum crew, minimal everything except the beauty of the surroundings,
maximum tilde,
and maximum everything you also expect from Almodovar in terms of how, you know, how everything looks, you know, his direction, all of the formal qualities that give you the endless sensations that you feel when you are watching his films. They're all here. They are distilled into a 30-minute concentrated dose. And I wanted to watch it again immediately after we were finished watching it. Now I can because it is streaming on HBO Max.
Yes.
Finally.
With about 10 or so other Almodovar titles. Too,
yes. So not only that, it's emotionally satisfying as well because it is very much in keeping with so many of his other films and his the through line of his obsessions keeps moving through this. It's, you know, what is real? What is the what is a performance?
Right.
What is
theater?
What is theater and what is true? And what is, you know, genuine emotion and what is the simmering seeds of revenge? Like, what is going on in this person's mind? You find out. And you find out some other stuff by the end.
Yeah.
But it is, like I said, it's this concentrated blast of everything you want from him. And her. So
even the shout outs to other filmmakers and to novelists, and in this case, many of them are kind of just sort of shouts out to himself.
Yeah.
You know, she's tidying up books and DVDs, and one of the books is Music for Chameleons, which is referenced in All About My Mother. And one of them is the film that he's about to make, the adaptation of the novel, A Manual for Cleaning Women by Lucia Berlin, or the short story collection. You know, there are, like, Criterion discs of Douglas Sirk movies, who has been, like, you know, who has been a big influence on Almodovar's work. So, yeah, all all of that stuff is there in a delicious 30-minute package.
Yes. And the Almodovar film for children this week is The Mitchells versus the Machines.
It's so great.
Why don't you... first of all, it's on Netflix. There's no doubt in my mind it was going to be theatrical.
Surely it must.
This is a big, this is a big
production.
Animated feature. This is not, some little, thing that someone tossed off here.
No.
From Michael Rionda and Jeff Rowe.
Yes.
Those are names I don't really know.
They were behind a show called Gravity Falls.
Okay.
That I've never seen, but people that we know who love animation love that show.
Yeah.
And it's produced by Lord & Miller,
yep.
Who I think, you can sort of sense their brand in this. There was somebody that I knew on Facebook who was saying that, you guys, when you're talking about Mitchell versus the Machine, neither Lord nor Miller directed this movie. And I responded, yeah.
Who said this?
Someone I know on Facebook.
Okay.
And I responded, yeah, Disney didn't direct any features either.
Yeah.
So you know what I mean. So this is a story about a teenager, Katie Mitchell. She feels like an outsider. She has wanted to be a filmmaker all of her life. And her once close relationship with her father seems to be quite strained, particularly because he, it's a thing where she wants to be an artist and he doesn't think that's practical and, doesn't want her to put all of her education into something that's not going to get her anywhere in life. And so, she's very excited about going away to school and getting away from her family for a while. And because he is worried that they're growing apart, he cancels her airline ticket and says, "We're going to drive cross country mm-hmm. and take you to your new college in California," which she is not thrilled about. So you have Abby Jacobson as Katie, Danny McBride as her father, Rick, doing a very non-Danny McBride kind of performance.
Yeah. This is just dad.
Yeah, and in a good way. Maya Rudolph is the mom, Linda, and then co-director Michael Rionda plays her a dinosaur-obsessed younger brother, Aaron. So it's your typical family road trip. They're getting on each other's nerves, and they're stuck in a car with their hilarious dog named Monchi, who is voiced by internet celebrity Doug the Pug, who I'd never heard of, and Christy Lemire shamed me about that. But, apparently Doug the Pug is a thing, and he is the...
Does Christy Lemire know about Milky Joe?
You'd have to ask her yourself.
Well, then. That's a celebrity cat to me.
There you go.
Yeah.
Anyway, so things are already getting tense. And then midway through their road trip, the robot apocalypse happens because a tech designer voiced by Eric Andre creates an AI voiced by Olivia Colman that basically takes his helper robots and forces them to round up all of humanity so she can shoot them into space. But the only people that they don't manage to get are the Mitchells. And so it's...
Because they bumble their way through everything.
Absolutely.
They don't fall in line easily.
Yes.
Yeah.
Unlike their perfect neighbors, who are voiced by John Legend and Chrissy Teigen. So the Mitchells have to fight back against the machines and fix their own sort of fraught family issues.
And it reminds me a lot, and I don't think this is a coincidence, it reminds me a lot of Into the Spider-Verse.
Sure.
Because it doesn't stick to one thing.
Mm.
It is constantly throwing a lot of visual confusion at you. So much so that, unlike Spider-Verse, where I left the movie theater and called you...
Wondering if you were supposed to have gotten 3D glasses.
Wondering if I was looking at the right... Am I in the right theater? Is this, supposed to be 3D, but I don't know it? Why does everything look like there are two things happening at the same time on the screen? I admit that I was dumb that day. This film is one in which... I hate to say this because it feels almost like a warning, but if you are... sensitive to flashing and strobing and lights and frenetic imagery and things just like
popping up.
Popping out at you. It's not a 3D movie. But if you are sensitive to that kind of thing and it wears you down, perhaps, maybe watch it on Netflix instead of, I assume it's also playing theatrically.
It opened in theaters a week before it launched on Netflix.
Yeah. Because I sat on the couch watching it thinking, this might overwhelm me if I were watching it in a theater. There's so much coming at you and so much going on. And it's not just that it's loud and bright. It's that the frame is filled with stuff. So much stuff that watching it twice is probably a necessity.
Oh, for sure.
For you to catch everything. Freeze framing certain parts is probably also a necessity because there are little jokes that fly past you.
It's like the old Mad Magazine where they would just cram the margins with little gags and drawings and stuff. Yeah, there's a lot happening in this movie.
But it's a delight.
Oh, yeah.
It's truly delightful. And it is a story that you encountered before, you know, oh, we're a family of misfits. We have to do the thing and come together and learn how to love each other. And that, obviously, that's the thing. That's what you can hang on. You can hang everything else that's in this film on that idea.
And even that idea, I think, in this case, has some real specificity to it.
It does. It has a lot of it because you learn who the father is and why he is behaving the way he is, and the mom, and the little brother, not just the main character, Katie.
Right.
And one of the things you learn about Katie, Alonzo.
I'm dense, and I kind of missed this.
If you're paying even a little bit of attention, is that she's queer. And it's coded. They don't say the word, oh, this is a teenage lesbian. But everything else happening in the story is informing you that this person is queer, and she's got her little rainbow button on. Mm-hmm. She's got you know, her little haircut. She's got...
Look, I've been beaten down by the media for 50 plus years. I don't even hope for that kind of thing anymore.
This is a lead character.
In a movie, in a family film.
Main character, who is a little teenage lesbian.
Yes. Little Sadie Benning.
Kinda, yeah. And then they make it very clear at the end when the mom is asking her, are you bringing your girlfriend home for Thanksgiving from college? So, sorry, spoiler, but you know, it's something that you learn really within the first 10 to 15 minutes.
What I also admire about this movie, in addition to sort of making the stakes as much about the Mitchells as they are about the machines, there is a bit of, like, this movie absolutely traffics in the joke of, like, everybody's looking at their screens all the time.
Right.
Everybody relies on these devices to do things for them, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And they score points there, and they do find the humor in that.
And they also go in on the idea of unregulated tech monopolies.
Absolutely.
As well, even though, you know, it's from...
Netflix and Sony, thanks.
Tech monopolies.
But at the same time, the movie isn't just sort of knee-jerk, screens are bad, phones are bad, you are shit.
Right.
Like, it actually figures out a balance of... But look at the good they can do.
Look at what this young girl has made.
Yeah, exactly. Look, this girl who does not have access to the traditional tools of filmmaking has become an artist and is finding her creative.
She makes these little Michel Gondry-esque, films.
And so I like that. I like that it wasn't just the one sort of like, man, you put that phone down and smell a flower, kid. It has more than that to say about it. I love this movie.
It's truly, it's wonderful. And there's just great voice cast.
Oh, Beck Bennett and Fred Armisen.
Beck Bennett and Fred Armisen. And you said John Legend and Chrissy Teigen. Charlene Yee, Conan O'Brien. It's cool. It's a cool movie. It's fun. It's great for, you know, family to watch together. It's sweet. It's got a lot to show you. It's got a lot to say.
Yeah.
It's funny. The dog is great. I took a picture and I sent it to Aaron. I was like, look, Nigel is in a movie.
The you have Milky Joe on Instagram, and I follow Boof Mommy, who has a light colored pug and a dark colored pug, and the three of them sat down to watch this over the weekend, and I responded with a joke from the film about the dog, and we had a moment about that.
Now I also follow the other animal I follow on Instagram is Boss Mango Coco, who is a cat with an incredibly expressive face. And he's a chonk, and he lives in Korea, and he is he's got star power.
I was recently introduced, and I'm forgetting the name now, of a rescued Chihuahua who has a hilarious backstory and a lovely Instagram account, but I'm forgetting now. Prancer the Chihuahua.
Oh wait, now someone on the internet is describing Boss Mango Coco as a cat that lives in Japan. I thought he lived in Korea.
Oh, get it together, Dave White.
Well, I'm gonna have to double check on my information because I
Boss Mango Coco is a cat of the world.
I don't know. Now I don't know what the truth is. So I'll find
out. The last of the famous international play cats.
I will find out the answer.
Anyway, yes. So see Mitchell's vs. the Machines and see it more than once. I'm definitely planning to watch it again for the little things I missed and the gigantic thing that I missed, apparently. So looking forward to all of that.
We watched Without Remorse.
Yeah.
And that is that also only in theaters?
No, it's Amazon Prime.
Oh, so it's theaters and Amazon Prime.
Yeah.
Okay. I think the official title of this movie is Tom Clancy's
Without Remorse.
Without Remorse, but come on. It's called Without Remorse.
Yeah, but really they could have just called it Tom Clancy and its core audience would come running. Tom Clancy's, oh, you know.
Stefano Solima. Do I know that filmmaker?
He's the Sicario 2 guy.
That's right.
He also did the TV show Gomorrah, which I've heard good things about.
Yeah. So this is... Michael B. Jordan.
Mm-hmm.
He's a Navy SEAL.
Yep.
He's on one last mission.
Mm-hmm. You know how that goes.
And the bad things happen.
Yes.
While he's on one last mission. And then he goes home to his lovely wife, played by Lauren London.
Mm-hmm.
And then more bad things happen.
Yes.
And then Michael B. Jordan.
It's revenge time.
Is on a mission of vengeance. I hesitate to tell you the things because I want you to experience the cliche activities of this film fresh the way I did.
Oh, there's
because I'm the guy who watches movies like this and goes, oh no, what's coming next? And then I think, you've seen every movie like this your entire life.
Yeah.
You kind of know what's coming next. And yet at the same time, I'm thinking, oh no, they just killed blah, 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 you know, and I'm freshly stunned and freshly stoked. I sat on the couch with you yelling, get him, Michael B. Jordan, get him.
There is a third act bad guy reveal that you can see from space.
Still though. Still,
although
still
there is a
get him.
There is a character actor whom I greatly appreciate who is cast in such a tiny role here. I thought, oh well, surely there's going to be some reveal later. Like, oh no, you just cast this guy in a really tiny role. All right, fine then, movie. He got paid. I'm happy.
People get taken out in way. Well, people get taken out of this movie in ways I did not see coming, although I should have.
Yeah.
So it's this international, you know,
espionage,
globetrotting espionage, double crosses, secret identities,
CIA,
black ops, you know,
conspiracies.
And, yeah, conspiracies and, you know, suicide missions. And it's
kind of a bore.
I had such a great time watching this.
I can't begin to figure that out.
I was ready for all the vengeance that Michael B. Jordan was giving. Here's why I think I enjoyed it.
Because you have a goldfish memory?
That's one reason.
Okay.
I've been feeling, you know, like I want to take out all the bad guys. All of 2020.
Well, yeah.
And there have been so many. And so now Michael B. Jordan is doing it in this film. Another reason I like this movie. It is clearly the beginning of a franchise.
Oh, yeah. It is based on the first in a series of novels about this one character.
This character's name is John Kelly.
Yeah.
Or John Clark.
He's John Kelly at the beginning, and then I think when he has a new name, it's John Clark.
All right. So anyway.
Or vice versa, whatever. I don't know.
If this could become a franchise, think about the beginning of the Mission Impossible franchise and how perfunctory it felt. And then how over the years, it just got astonishingly cool and fun and great. So I'm already on board with this one.
Okay.
And if it could just be more like that over time, it's going to be even awesomer than the way I experienced it here. Hang on, I'm not done yet.
I'm so annoyed with people who like recommend TV shows where like you have to get through the first two seasons, and then it really kicks in.
I'll tell you something. I'm about finished with the first season of Schitt's Creek because everyone kept saying, "Stick with it, stick with it, stick with it." I'm sticking with it. It's still not grabbing me. And everyone keeps telling me, "Oh no!
I got further. You're gonna
You're really gonna love it." Yeah. After some time. And the people who are telling me this are people I believe in.
Yes.
And so I'm just going to keep going with it and just let it sort of casually wash over me.
Magic portal happens because I never got there.
But I'm already on board for this. And okay. I'm ready for more of the sequels. And here's the number one reason. Michael B. Jordan is acting.
Well, yeah.
Back in the 80s when these kinds of movies were everywhere and it was all like Chuck Norris,
Stallone, Schwarzenegger.
On a mission, you know. Those guys weren't giving me anything human, really, I didn't feel back then. But Michael B. Jordan is so good at his job that he is giving a performance. He is a man in this film who is consumed by grief and rage and that numbness that comes with, you know, serving your country that doesn't deserve you. And, you know, he's also, you know, kind of a superhuman,
killing machine,
fighting machine and vengeance machine, which is thrilling. But he is making it feel like a real person at the center of it. And I loved watching his reactions to other people either doing the wrong thing or screwing him over or anything. I totally enjoyed myself.
Yeah.
Is this a good movie? Probably not. But he's cool. I like the premise. And I liked watching him, you know, get him.
The premise is a lot of nothing. Okay. A country that doesn't deserve him and a movie that doesn't deserve him. Because Michael B. Jordan is the one thing in this movie that is special. He is giving a performance. He is giving a performance about loss and grief and stuff in the middle of things blowing up. And like he's the one interesting thing in this mass of just cliches and spy movie filler that we're getting otherwise. Jodie Turner-Smith is great as his superior officer. There are a handful of sequences that really pop. There's a prison scene where he has to fight off a bunch of people. It's kind of cool. It reminded me of the Rorschach moment in Watchmen. There's a plane crash that's really great. I know you love a good plane crash in a movie. There's a setting an SUV on fire scene that's pretty good. But beyond that it's just
plane
like
plane scene. Made me immediately think of friends of ours who work on sets and how the people who designed the plane scene and who were tasked with making it look like it looked and do what it did probably were having the best week of their life. And then the people who we know who work on sets whose job it is to keep everyone organized and make and schedule people and make things happen. They were having the worst week of their life. When I see something that elaborate and practical taking place in a film,
like people in water and stuff.
I think, some people were in heaven and other people were in hell.
But apart from like these sort of, every so often there'd be some like dazzling moment, and Jordan is good throughout and Turner Smith is good throughout. But other than that, it was just like, it was just such a slog.
And that's like the SUV on fire scene is also fantastic.
Yes.
So you have to give it those two things at least.
I'm the one who mentioned them. I know. Giving him all that all stuff and the prison scene. Yeah. But still, this movie,
the prison fight scene is fantastic.
Yes, but apart from those moments,
this movie's cool.
This movie's a morass of whatever with a really good central performance.
This movie is cool.
And if it is indeed going to be a franchise, which they clearly want it to be, and if it becomes as fun and off the hook as, you know, yeah, the first three Mission Impossible movies are kind of whatever. The first four Fast and the Furious movies are kind of whatever, except for Tokyo Drift. Sometimes franchises do sort of achieve another plane of existence where they matter. If that happens to this one, great. But this one stinks, and I bet you the next two will also stink.
So fine, we disagree.
Yeah.
Last week was the Academy Awards.
Yes, it was.
And the documentary category was populated by really amazing documentaries.
Mm-hmm.
Crip Camp.
Yep.
Life.
Mm-hmm. No, Time.
Sorry. Crip Camp, Time, which we reviewed a few weeks back.
Uh-huh.
And Collective.
Yes, my favorite film of 2020.
And then there was another one.
And The Mole Agent, which I haven't seen, but everybody says is great.
We still have not seen that. And then the one that got the Academy Award.
Correct.
My Octopus Teacher.
Yeah.
From Pippa Ehrlich and James Reed.
Mm-hmm.
It's about a man in South Africa.
Yes.
Who works in film.
He's a cinematographer.
He's a cinematographer. And he was burned out, midlife crisis.
Craig Foster.
Craig Foster is his name. Has always lived near the water, near the ocean, and always been sort of in love with being in the ocean, going underwater, exploring things. His entire life.
Yeah.
Very comfortable in the water. Meets an octopus lady. And apparently took a year off from work to sort of decompress and, you know, if you can do it, nice, you know. He did that. And he went into the water every single day to hang out with the octopus lady. And they became friends. I mean, as much as you can be friends with a person, if you're an octopus.
Yeah, and vice versa.
You know, she's in the water all day being like, oh, him again.
This guy.
This guy. What's he doing?
Trying to eat.
Just staring at me.
Stop watching me while I eat. I hate that.
Got a camera with him. First of all, it looks beautiful.
Oh, yeah. On the a underwater, craft level.
The underwater photography is gorgeous.
Yes.
Also terrifying. Being under the water is not on my list of things that I want to be.
Sure.
Like, I would love to watch your underwater documentary about the ocean and show me all the freaky creatures and stuff. I just don't want to be... Listen.
Wet.
A school of jellyfish coming at me is not what I'm thinking is a fun day.
Right.
Little sharks all swimming around in a
pack
group. Also not where I want to be.
Sure.
This guy's like, oh, look at the sharks. He knows things. Like, he knows, oh, those sharks have little to no interest in me.
Right.
As anything. Not as a diversion, not as a meal, nothing.
No.
They are going to try to eat my lady friend here, the octopus.
Yes, they are.
So he's, you know, observing her as she hides.
And if they want to find her, all they have to do is look for the 6-foot-tall human suspended in the water and think, the octopus can't be far from her stalker. Movie never mentions that, but it's like, you know, those sharks figured it out.
The sharks figured it out.
Wait a minute, if he's here.
Hey, everybody, check out Dude. Lunch is somewhere hiding.
Mr. Trunks is pointing the way.
And, you know, he learns a lot over the course of the year about octopus behavior.
Yes. And they have an amazing ability to camouflage themselves.
Oh, listen. She does some stuff with shells that will blow your mind.
Yeah.
Worth looking at just for the all of that.
Sure.
In the long run, though, as a film of some sort of substance, it's a beautiful, trip under the water. It's a little too much about this guy's
personal journey.
I'm sure that it did him a world of good to get away from his, you know, hectic
career
life and to do this thing. But I don't really have a ton of patience with anthropomorphizing animals. I know I just said I followed several of them on Instagram. Because they are my friends.
Of course.
My internet friends. The animals. The cats.
I'm trying to imagine like Jacques Cousteau being like,
but I'm under no illusion that this is real.
The impressive manta ray. My wife and I have not spoken for 2 weeks. I think she is mad that I spend so much time on the Calypso. Perhaps the manta ray can teach me.
You are offending all the French people.
To be a better right person.
In ways that I could never do, just because I can't pronounce French words.
Anyway, yes. It's like we were talking about this on Breakfast All Day. Christy made us watch it, or made me watch it after it won the Oscar.
She hates this.
She hates this movie. Okay, so like, we have to talk about this. And I see why people love it, and I see why people hate it. Because yes, you're right. All the nature stuff is amazing. It looks extraordinary. You see things that I've never seen a lobster swim before. Like, you know,
that was propelling itself with its
tail. Yeah, that was very cool. And apparently, according to marine biologists, this guy gets his facts right.
Yeah.
And you see the octopus like learning through repetition, like how to do things and how to capture certain kinds of, you know, prey or whatever.
Right.
But it all keeps coming back to him, and it's like, dude, you're not the story here.
I mean, he kind of is.
I mean, he makes himself the story, but it's not the octopus that's the problem here. It's the my.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, so that's where this movie loses me, and it becomes so much about this dude, and it's like it'd be like if you were watching, if it were, I don't know, somebody were making, you know, on the ground in some like war-torn thing and making it all about his own safety or his own concerns, and it's like there's a war going on behind you.
There's a shark and octopus war going on.
Exactly. So yeah, it is worth seeing
it's like I said, it's very sweet.
But
and
that Oscar is nonsense.
There are at least 3 other better documentaries.
Yeah. We'll check on the 4th and get back to you.
In the category of films that were nominated, and that none of them won the Academy Award.
And, you know, even if you want to put aside Crypt Camp, even though it's powerful and beautiful and inspiring, for maybe not being, like, formally exciting.
Okay, sure.
Collective and Time are both, like, doing new, interesting things with documentary filmmaking.
Yeah, they both play with the form of what you're used to.
Yeah.
Collective, particularly,
mm-hmm.
you know, sure does love its Frederick Wiseman.
But I think, but also, and, but ratchets up.
Why the, shouldn't you?
But ratchets up the tension at right. the same time, which is not a thing that Wiseman ever
no,
feels
Wiseman
like
doesn't
doing.
Care about that.
And I have to say, like, I think I appreciate Time more having just rewatched Julie Dash's Daughters of the Dust because she talks about making the film in a way that felt like her style of narrative as a black woman, as a black storyteller.
Yes.
And I think that Time does this, it does the same thing in that, like, Daughters of the Dust is not a movie that necessarily travels in a straight line.
It absolutely does not.
But by the time you get to the end of the film, you know everything you need to
know.
You know
the story, right.
And Time does the same thing.
Yes. Yeah. So this is fine.
Yeah.
My octopus teacher is fine.
Yeah.
Nice. Nice octopus.
Everyone else was robbed.
Yeah. Do you have a DVD or streaming pick of the week?
Well, first I wanted to mention real quick that did we say that we're doing Limbo and Together later?
Yes, we did.
We did. Okay. All right.
Yes.
So I want to make sure that hadn't been forgotten. Sure. My streaming pick is a Julian Armstrong documentary that I saw at the USA Film Festival in 1989.
Wow.
And that never, to my knowledge, got any kind of home video release in the United States. It was never on VHS. It was never on DVD. But it is now streaming on Canopy. And it is called Bingo, Bridesmaids, and Braces.
Okay.
And it was the third in a series of films that she did that are akin to the 7-Up movies that Michael Apted made, where she basically focused on a trio of young women in Australia. I think she filmed them at 14 and then at 18, and then this one is in their 20s. And, you know, like the Apted films, it is about, you know, sort of watching people grow up in front of you and seeing where their lives go and where they, you know, what their youthful ambitions were and where they wound up and what they're making of their lives as adults. And it's a really beautiful film. And I am, of course, a huge, huge Julian Armstrong fan. And so I'm thrilled that people, I've thought about this movie so much and have
right.
never been able to show it to people because you couldn't get it in the US and now you can. So go to Canopy and check out Bingo, Bridesmaids, and Braces. And I think they might have one of the earlier ones, which I haven't seen that I want to, called 14's Good, 18's Better.
Hmm. Well, my recommendation is a film that we have talked about probably too many times in the past 12 months, but now it's on Blu-ray.
Oh.
And it is a forgotten musical from the 50s that stars Debbie Reynolds, and it's called Athena.
Yes.
And it is about a family of
health food fanatics
whose daughters are basically the seven muses.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're not just, I mean, they're not basically, they are.
Yeah.
And they,
the hapless men who enter into their orbit.
They take over the lives of pretty much everyone they meet. They feng shui a guy's
house.
They feng shui a guy's house.
They take all the meat and fish out of his fridge.
With a musical number.
Oh, yeah.
It must be seen to be believed. I can't get enough of it. It doesn't make sense, but
that it's existed all this time. Like,
yeah.
I had never heard of it. It's a 50s MGM musical.
And it just popped up on TCM right at the beginning of the pandemic.
Yeah.
And we sat down and we watched it and we were just like gobsmacked.
Slack-jawed. What is this? Yes, Warner Archive Collection just put Athena out on Blu-ray. You need this movie in your collection.
You should. You'll like it. I mean, if you're like us.
You've never seen anything like it. I'll say that much.
Letters. Julius says, hey, classic podcasters. I'm catching up on some of the episodes from September and October. Happy belated 10th anniversary.
Oh, thanks, Julius.
I know doing clip shows would be hard work to search and find, but you should crowdsource that. I'm sure there are favorite moments that fans have. Let me start. Episode number 500. A beau travail is probably the most Siskel and Ebert argument I think I can remember you all having. It seems to be in the midst of a period where Alonzo was feeling rather feisty on the mic because I kept shouting, shots fired. Additionally, I agree with Dave on this one, but I see Alonzo's points.
Thank you.
Other great moments include the Make Me viewing of Higher Ground, mm-hmm. which inspired me to watch that film, and it is amazing. The episode of Linoleum Nights where you played Dennis Hensley's board game, You Don't Know My Life.
That was a great one.
The episode with guest Rachel True.
Mm-hmm.
The review of The Space Between Us, a.k.a. Candy Bones.
Candy Bones.
All episodes with Manola Darkness.
No argument here.
As the most swearifying guest we ever have, must be bleeped 3 to 4 times every time she's on.
Worth it.
We wouldn't have it any other way. Also, there are probably moments from Bibbs and Whitney episodes back in the day when they used to be regulars. You know, they did used to be regulars, and then they became their own, like...
network.
Incredibly busy network and industry, and they don't have time to guess.
Maybe we can do Christmas in July again this year.
Maybe. Maybe. Finally, I'm in love with Linoleum Knights. Sorry. Linoleum Knife presents more Linoleum Knife.
Oh, thank you.
But can we get more queer classics on here? I would love hearing about them, especially new queer cinema ones. It would be interesting to hear from the gay elders how specific films were influenced by the times in which they were released. Or you could just gush about the beauty and homoeroticism of Carell. And I'll listen. Do you want to do Carell as an episode? Why not?
Okay, sure. Let's
do
it. Oh, hey, speaking of which, the TCM Film Festival is happening this week. And
speaking of queer things, here comes something.
Yeah, it's happening on TCM and on HBO Max. And if you go to HBO Max, they have included Victim as part of their lineup of classic films.
Ooh, Alonzo, what do you know about that film?
Well, they if you scroll down to the extras, you'll see a couple of things. One is the conversation that Dave Karger and I had last summer when they screened the film on TCM. And then also, I was rather pleasantly surprised to see a brief history of American LGBT cinema that was a segment I worked on for Filmstruck.
And I forgot you did it.
Yeah, I kind of forgot about it too.
Absolutely forgot you did that.
So that's there, and there are clips of Carell in it because that was part of the package of films that I was introducing. I would not be unhappy if more stuff that I created for Filmstruck found its way to HBO Max, because I'm proud of a lot of it.
Well, it means it still exists somewhere in a...
Someone's got it. It's on a server somewhere.
Yeah, it's on a server somewhere.
So, like, you know, if they want to... I did a lot of Eric Rohmer stuff. I did a lot of Derek Jarman. So, yeah, let's do it.
Tim from Baltimore says, the one thing that will stay with me after this year's Oscars is the setting. A visual shout out to very old Hollywood when the Oscars took place in rooms not much bigger than a Vegas nightclub.
Yeah. Hollywood Roosevelt.
Populating that background with a diverse representation of new Hollywood made a far stronger statement than any speech ever could.
Yeah.
Seeing a black DJ where Guy Lombardo usually sat was subtly earth-shaking, at least for this old man. The wide diversity of people giving thanks to the Academy in that space still sends shivers down my spine.
Good point, Tim.
Kevin. Subject line. Airport disaster movies. Your recent discussion of the airport genre brought to mind, the airport franchise, brought to mind the 1990 epic CBS television movie Miracle Landing, starring Wayne Rogers and Connie Selica, so you know it must be excellent entertainment. The full film is on YouTube.
Ooh.
Based on a true life story, the upper fuselage of a Hawaiian Airlines jet rips off over the ocean, and Wayne and Connie must land the plane somehow.
Whoa.
Oh, and a flight attendant gets sucked out of the plane while doing beverage service. Oh my, I don't want to know about that. I have a few memories of watching this film when it aired. Number one, Flight attendant Anna Alicia from Falcon Crest has seen chewing drama while struggling up the aisle to assist passengers, at least one of whom is still hitting on her. Paper and other assorted stuff is still blowing around the cabin, even though a flight attendant just got sucked out of the cabin. Wayne's aviator glasses get sucked out of the cabin, too. Connie Selica's co-pilot hat remains in place. No one is breathing normally into the oxygen masks because the roof of the plane is missing. But the masks are strangely still there, flapping about. Anna Alicia finally gets to the front of the plane and more or less assumes the homecoming queen position, you know, like on the back deck of the convertible, waving to the crowd, bravely looking ahead in the open sky all around her. Oddly, her hair and her life jacket are unflappable. Anna Alicia then throws herself seat by seat back to coach. It's never explained why she made the quest to the front of the plane. Do you need to pause the recording so that you can cough properly?
No, I'll be fine.
Are you okay?
I'm okay.
All right. Missed opportunity showing the flight attendant being sucked out of the plane. I felt really cheated. See, I would not feel cheated about that. That is like...
This is made for TV. Come
this
on.
Is the terror of my life. After every commercial break, there's an establishing shot of a miniature plane without a roof flying through the clouds, in case you forgot what was going on. Anyway, it's an over-the-top 1990s star-studded disaster flick, and I would be remiss if I didn't bring it to your attention as part of the airport continuum. My husband, Randy, and I listen to the podcast most nights after dinner ever since the pandemic began. Probably the best decision we made in 2020 was to go full Patreon to have access to all of the fine Linoleum Knife family of podcasts. Thank you so much, your faithful listener, Kevin.
Oh, God. Well, two things. First of all, I need a bumper sticker that says Connie Selica is my co-pilot. And secondly, we have a Patreon at patreon.com/linoleumknife, where we have lots of extras, including the aforementioned Linoleum Knife presents More Linoleum Knife, LKRX, our daily recommendations of things, LKTV, Linoleum Knife and Fork, where we talk about food, Linoleum Nights, where we talk about all sorts of things. Yeah, so check it out, patreon.com/linoleumknife.
Yeah, we got stuff.
Yeah.
You want to buy it? We're selling it.
Yeah, that's right.
A lot of content.
Indeed.
We're content providers.
Gah! We're letter providers.
I just said that to make you cringe.
Thank you.
You're welcome. We're done. I have to go make mac and cheese now.
I thought there were other letters.
No.
Oh, okay.
That's the end of letters.
Never mind then. Yeah. All right. Well, thanks everybody for listening. We will catch you next time. Check out our friends on the internet. Bibbs and Whitney, of course, over on Critically Acclaimed. The Schmoes Know, Dennis Enwin with Dennis Hensley. The Comics Canon, Sewers of Paris, All Things Cozy. Check out my other shows, the untitled Iffy, Drea, and Alonzo Project, which is currently going through the Max Fun Drive. So if you can support there, please do. And we're having a contest for a new name of the show. I'm also on Breakfast All Day. I'm also on A Film and a Movie. And I'm also on Deck the Hallmark every Monday.
Blurgalurg. That's my name suggestion for the...
Blurgalurg.
Blurgalurg.
Okay, well, you have to send it to the right email address, right, or it doesn't count.
All right.
Yeah, and just all the other folks. Follow us at LinoleumCast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Subscribe at Apple Podcasts. Leave us a 5-star review. We'll read it on the air. You could also leave us positive feedback in all the places that we stream: Stitcher Radio, TheLounge.com, Spotify, Google Play, CastBox, Amazon Music, Podbean, the whole nine yards. We're at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you, Blue, for our theme music. Check him out at Blutopia on Twitter.
Yep.
And BLEUTOPIA. Until next time.
Goodbye.